Welcome to Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
It is good to be here, and we've been talking about the pre-Reformation, and today we're going to talk about Renaissance Rome.
Yeah, right. What we're planning on doing is last week, as you say, we were looking at the pre-Reformation period where theologians who were taking people out of the church.
Right.
And we'll see how that happens in a couple weeks. This week we're going to look at the center itself. We'll be looking at what's going on in Rome with the Renaissance popes. There are about seven of them.
Oh,
and,
wow. They have many.
Yeah, there is a good number, yeah. And what they were doing and why they were doing what they were doing. And then next week our game plan is that we'll be looking at the reformers in the church mm-hmm. who are keeping people in the church,
okay.
who are heading toward the center while others are heading toward the doors.
Okay.
Okay, so with all of that, then we can see in some perspective this incredible fissuring of Christendom
mm-hmm.
that the Reformation represents.
Right,
okay.
Great.
Well, to understand the Reformation, Renaissance Rome, or to understand the Renaissance popes, you have to understand humanism. And we talked a little bit about humanism before. Some of the humanists had been secretaries and writers and all at around the time of the Council of Constance,
mm-hmm.
and they had been gathering books. You had now with the coming of the printing press. Now books are starting to be published. Tracts are starting to be published. There are books that had been from antiquity that everyone thought lost,
mm-hmm.
and in fact they were discovered in some of these monasteries at around the time of the Council of Constance, and so now these are getting translated into modern languages. Some of them are being printed, some in Latin, some in modern languages, and so there's a whole group of young up and coming intellectuals who were not attracted to the old way of learning, which are the big old universities, which had been around for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for a new way of doing that. And they're often referred to as humanists.
Right. Okay.
That's a very broad term. Probably the first individual that wore that term goes back to the beginning of our course, actually, as we were first starting to talk, and that was Petrarch, Francesco Petrarch. Now, he lived from 1304 to 1374, so he lived basically during the Avignon period, you know.
Okay.
So that's right at the beginning, and then you go through some of the others, people like Giovanni Boccaccio, Thomas More, and then all the way up to Desiderius Erasmus. Both More and Erasmus are considered to be humanists, and their death dates are Thomas More is murdered, of course, in 1535. Erasmus dies a natural death in 1536. So when you look at starting with the birth of Petrarch in 1304,
mm-hmm.
and you're calling him a humanist, and then Erasmus dying in 1536, that's 232 years later, and they're still using that term humanist,
uh-huh.
that's a much broader term then. We're talking more about an attitude than we are a literary movement.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. Uh-huh.
And I think seen under those circumstances, we can understand that. By and large, humanists are people who use the term humanist.
Mm-hmm.
The term humanista was very common in to describe a lot of things. One of those would be the whole new style of schools that were coming up. Rather than sending your children or young men to the university, you might be sending them to an academy instead,
okay.
an academy of the fine arts, the bone artes, the artes liberales, the liberal arts. We're beginning to hear a lot of people major in liberal arts today. They were all
right.
liberal arts departments in universities. These were schools of the liberal arts. And the idea behind that, of course, is liber, the free. These arts, by studying these arts, free you up. Sometimes it's referred to as the humanae artes, the human arts. And the whole idea behind these, whether they be schools or libraries or ways of speaking about literature, art, whatever, is the central notion that and the recognition that man, that the human being is unique in the entire world. Now, that's not a new revelation. You know, that's certainly been part and parcel of Judeo-Christian mindset from mm-hmm. you know, from the beginning. But here is a different way of looking at that. And so these are young thinkers who are, first of all, confirming the dignity of the human being, recognizing the uniqueness of the human being. And they answer the question, why? Why is a human being unique? And their answer is that we are animals, like all other animals, but we have this want to learn, this drive to learn. And what they're implying here is something that we refer to in philosophy and psychological philosophy as reflective reasoning. Humans are the only animals that we know of that not only know things, but we know that we know things.
Right. Okay.
And then some of us are clever enough to know that we know things.
No.
And you do that four or five times, you end up in an institution for a while, getting back down to earth. But that's it. And so why is the human then driven toward knowing more things? And their answer is in order to be refined in virtue.
Okay.
Now that's a charged Latin term, the virtue.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the old Latin term virtus, which comes from virus, meaning man. Not homo, the generic human being, but specifically males.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to early Roman education. We're talking the early Republic here.
Okay.
And education prior to coming in contact with the Greeks, Roman education meant that young boys would learn how to be men by being around men and seeing how men act. If men act in a virtuous way, those virtues would then be passed on. That was the primary purpose behind early Roman education, early Republican education. And so there's this sense of this virtue. Now, by this time, this is broken out into all human beings
mm-hmm.
Have this capacity and this desire to be virtuous, to live virtuous lives.
Okay. So are there Christian humanists?
Yeah, that's a good point, because you have the general humanists, and then more specifically, you're going to have humanists. Many of these people who are humanists are themselves Christian,
mm-hmm.
and they bring their worldview of Christianity, their own conviction of Christianity to humanism, and so they'll see that the human being is unique in this desire for virtue, in this desire for learning, in this reflective reasoning. And then the next question is why? You know, you're doing mm-hmm. all these whys. And the answer to that is because we're made in the image and likeness of God.
Right.
Now that's the difference, really, bottom line difference between Christian humanism and secular humanism. Secular humanism says you're doing fine until you added that last part. You know, a Christian humanist, and there's nothing wrong with being a humanist, especially
right.
if you're a Christian, is reconfirming that dignity of the human person, that search for virtue, that search for learning, that reflective reasoning is hardwired us.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why we're hardwired toward that kind of a life is because God has created us in that way, in His image and likeness, and not only that, but also redeemed us in that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, became a human being, adding greater dignity to the dignity of the human being.
All right.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, one of the primary examples of this is one of the Renaissance popes himself. This was Pope Pius II.
Okay.
And a very interesting man. He was found a career in church courts, in princely courts, He was born of an impoverished noble family. This is a family in central Italy. They had lost all their money, but they were of noble birth. And therefore, it's a really interesting kind of a mix in that you have a family milieu of refinement, of learning. There are books around, you know, which is not common.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense that people have of holding yourself up a little bit higher. And then at the same time, coming from a poor family, he had to work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the best of both worlds in many ways. Someone who is searching for that virtue, and then at the same time is a hard worker.
Right.
And so this was certainly true for his experience. He was able to attend the University of Siena. Remember Catherine of Siena?
Right.
And then later on, left Siena, went to Florence, where he was, he began taking reading courses. So he would read books under the leadership, the guidance of a mentor, some university professor. And then after doing that for a couple of years, left Florence, went back to Siena, and took a degree in law. He studied law. So this is he's got a lot going for him already.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know? And around that time, the bishop of Siena was looking for a secretary.
Okay.
And so many of these humanists, remember, were hired up, snatched up by bishops and cardinals and popes as speech writers and as literary experts and all of this. And so he found himself doing the same thing. Interestingly enough, he was not leading an exemplary life. You know, there is no Saint Pius II. He was making money off the church, like a lot of people were at the time. And interestingly enough, he found himself taking a pilgrimage to Scotland.
Okay.
And while in Scotland, he had a religious experience that was somehow tied to gout. I'm not entirely sure how this was necessarily related. But the important thing is that at the end of the pilgrimage, all of a sudden, his whole life was set before him, and he decided that it was not what he had intended to do,
mm-hmm.
and he was certainly not doing God's will in doing the kind of life that he was leading. For one thing, he had already had two illegitimate children,
mm-hmm.
Before this. Now, you know, we could throw some brickbats at him, but St. Augustine, I think,
had a
past also. Well, at 37 years old, he left Siena and took another job as the secretary for the Holy Roman Emperor.
Okay.
This was Frederick III. And arriving there at the court, at the court of the Holy Roman Emperor, not only acting as secretary, but also writing plays, writing histories. By the time he was 40 years old, so he been there basically 3 years.
Okay.
He turned around to the emperor and said, I'm out of here. This is not what I need to do for the rest of my life, being a pious and good layman
mm-hmm.
working for the state.
Okay.
Instead, he went back to Italy, studied for the priesthood, and was ordained.
Wow.
And so there he was. He's on the fast track. He's ordained at the age of 40. The age of 41...
Wow.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's like real fast. At the age of 41, 1 year later, he was named a bishop.
Oh, my gosh.
10 years later, at the age of 51, he was made a cardinal. And at 53 years old, he was elected pope.
Wow.
So, you know, relatively young man, very vigorous. He is in every way a Renaissance man. You know, we use that term, the Renaissance man. He is that. You know, he has a classical education. He's read history. He's read literature. He's a wonderful writer. He really is a wordsmith. I mean, that's what he did, you know,
right.
As a job. He's a poet. He's a diplomat. He is fluent in Italian and German as well as the classical languages. And added to all of that, he is a dedicated churchman. And so he really is a tremendous influence. As people look at the Renaissance popes, we often zero in on a couple of notorious popes, mm-hmm. which I'll talk about in a couple minutes. But here's someone else who is very much into the new learning, very much into using the new learning to evangelize yet another generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Pius II is that example. So as we look at that, I think it's important for us to look also at the shift that takes place in the mindset of these humanists as they look at history, because that's going to have a real impact also in the way that they look at themselves and they see society. You know, when you look at institutions, they're just weren't created in a vacuum,
right?
You know, and so like being in love with the church, what does that mean? And you know, and so you find yourself asking those kind of questions, which ultimately lead you back to history.
Right, and what difference does it make how we view history?
Yeah, I think very important, because if we look at history as being static,
mm-hmm.
then it looks as though nothing changes,
right,
and nothing grows. On the other hand, if you look at history as being dynamic and changing and mm-hmm. growing, and people coming into it and going out of it, I think there's a whole other respect that you have for the institutions, for one thing, that you inherit, and that's one thing, and the other is that you're going to pass on. I hear this so often from pastors who, especially pastors who are about to enter into a capital campaign, remind the people that the church that they're praying in right now, they did not build.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that so often true? It's their parents and grandparents that built that church, and That's important to be able, as you walk into that church, to remember that,
right,
that you have a legacy of someone's gift to you. But the other thing is, the pastors, if they're really on a roll on this, is they're going to remind people also that the gift that this generation gives is a gift not to this generation, but to the next
mm-hmm.
generation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a tie-in of history, past, present, and future. A dynamic sort of a thing. And there is this shift that's taking place even among, and certainly among the humanists as they grapple to understand history. The classical literature that is available is really influential in transforming the interpretations. For one thing, our own divisions of historical epochs begin to change. Previously, throughout the Middle Ages and into the early modern period, basically we looked at history as divided into two sections. This is very much influenced, by the way, by the theology of St. Augustine. And basically what you have is a period of darkness that continues on until the coming of Christ, and then light after mm-hmm. that, with the founding of the church and the end times, which we are living in, you know. And so this was basically the way most everybody looked at history, and as a result also at the institutions. And this is going to change now with the humanists, who are finding so many of these old books and realizing that ancient times were not times of darkness, but
right.
instead there was great light. As they started looking at history and the developments of things, they find that you have what they referred to as the antiqua, the ancient times, and these are times of great institutions, of great learning, of libraries, of great philosophers, and they see this as basically coming to its culmination at the time of Constantine.
Okay.
The Emperor Constantine, for many of these people in the among the humanists, is a time when the entire world is brought together. Everything is clicking. That's probably pretty naive, but
mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's what they saw. Then what they're going to see is that what follows afterwards is not a period of light, but a period of darkness.
Okay.
Especially after 410 A.D., when the Vandals invade Rome, destroy the city of Rome. The library at Alexandria is burned with it. Incredible amounts of stuff that was just absolutely lost. We know that it was there because there are so many references and works that did survive, saying, oh, you know, if you to understand this more completely, you must consult Plato's book, yada, yada. And it's no longer in existence. It's gone. Where did it go? It went up in flames in Alexandria or in Rome. And so what happens is that the humanists look at that period afterwards as truly a dark ages, and hence we get the name. From their point of view, the Dark Ages persisted with us in one form or another. We did the best we could. And then, you know, so they kind of discount the High Middle Ages, which was this incredible century, the 13th century. Right. But they sort of like forget that. And what they remember is they remember the Huns and the Visigoths and Ostrogoths and all the other Goths. And then they remember the Hundred Years' War, the Papal Schism, the bubonic plague. And, you know, that was a pretty lousy century to live to, the 14th century.
Yes.
And then, so that's the 14th century, but they're living in the 15th century. Mm-hmm. This is a time when there is a rebirth of culture, you know, connecting with that ancient times. And as a result of that, you have the rebirth or renaissance that they speak of, this renaissance of humanism. As a result of that, their attitudes are full of optimism. And it's found in their writings and in their artwork and in their architecture. There are bold expressions, lots of new experiments, the kind of buildings that you find coming about in the 15th century demonstrate that. And really, the Renaissance popes are going to catch this this flavor and are going to run with it. They're going to in a sense, they're going to push the envelope as far as they possibly can in this new thinking. Their feeling is that the church is in the forefront of this, and so they want to be part and parcel of it. But always the center of all humanist effort is the human being himself, and Christian humanists created in the image and likeness of God, and therefore given this dignity that they have. You know. There's an historian by the name of Rice who said the following. I'd just like to give you a little quote on this. He says, "Making man the link between the sensible and intellectual worlds, God endowed him with magnificent gifts, attributing to him reason and free will, a most excellent gift and noble vestige of that supreme liberty with which God created all things." Very nicely said.
Yes.
Yeah. And then also in this, the over and over, the affirmation of free will. That's so important within the dignity of the human being, that the human being have that free will, that we are our own agents. Another reason why education is so important. It's not just the accumulation of facts, but the more we know about ourselves and the world around us, the more we can judge what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is not good. And so that you can see where free will and dignity and knowledge all come together in all of that. Well, one individual in particular is such a good example of this, besides Pius II also. But there's another Florentine by the name of Pico della Mirandello. And he, that's a heck of a name.
That is a name, isn't it?
Yeah. And he lives in Florence. He's in the second half, the last half of the 15th century, the 1400s. And he posits this idea of human dignity as located in man's free will. So if we do not have free will, we have no dignity as a human being. And he argues that that this human dignity, this free will that God gives us, breaks a bond, a chain that links us both to God above and animals below.
Okay.
So, and the ultimate result of this is that we then have, with our free will, we then have the free will decision to turn to God are to turn to creatures. You get the idea.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so he argues that. One of the beautiful quotes that comes from this is, Virtutus laus omnia in actione consistat. I'm going to give this to you because my Latin's not all that good,
no,
and I had to look it up.
Trying to figure out that one. I didn't get it. I gave it up too fast.
Yeah, what it tells us is that the praise of virtue
It
always consists in the action of it.
The praise of virtue always consists in the action of it.
Yeah,
you want
to praise virtue, show us.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's a wonderful description. In fact,
sounds like he's from Missouri.
Yeah. Mirandola was at the Fifth Lateran Council, which we'll say some things about a little bit later on today, and he gives a chilling challenge to the Pope. And this was Leo X.
Okay.
Next week we'll talk a little bit about this because he fits in as one of those reforming Catholics.
Okay. And this was Mirandola?
This is Mirandola, yeah.
Mirandola, okay.
Yeah. Pico della Donna. Well, let's go ahead and jump into the Renaissance popes themselves.
All right.
Cover at least a number of them. First one, everyone pretty much says, this guy is the one that starts the Renaissance as far as Rome is concerned, is Pope Nicholas V.
Okay.
He was elected in 1447. Remember that we have had a number of popes. We have, with Martin V, have been able to return to Rome once again after Constance. Eugenius IV, conciliarism, the government of the church by consuls has been put aside, but Italy is in bad shape, Rome is in bad shape, and so here comes Nicholas V, and he looks around and he sees a shabby city. Mm. You know, for one thing, the cathedral, the Basilica of Constantine, the forerunner of St. Peter's Basilica. It wasn't there, of course. It wasn't there. The Pope said Mass in a building that was 1,200 years old. Now, that's pretty neat, but the other side of it is, It was a dump.
There's no grandeur there.
Yeah, that's the word. There's no grandeur. And so he really sets about changing this and beginning to clear the way. It upset a lot of people when he tore the building down.
Oh.
I guess there wasn't any historical society back then.
Yeah.
But he did that in order to build a new cathedral, which ultimately will be St. Peter's, although his design is going to be very radically altered in all of that. He spends lots of his time on buildings, on the arts, sponsoring artists. He's very interested in science, encouraging scientists. We certainly have this prejudice in our own mind that religion is against science, anything but that.
Mm-hmm.
He's very much involved with science. And so here he begins doing all of this. The biggest problem he has, however, is finances.
I was going to say, where does he come up with the money for this?
that is a real problem.
Rome in a shambles.
Yeah, that's right. And so what he's doing, he's turning around to other parts of the church and trying to get money from them.
Okay.
And some, quite honestly, resent this. Later on, under the reign of Callistus III in 1456, the German bishops simply refused to send him tithes.
Okay.
You know, it was a big explosion, and for a while they held the tithes back, and then eventually they began paying again. But here you have, Rome is not a wealthy city.
Mm-hmm.
The Pope didn't have Peter's pence back then.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, they didn't have the Vatican stamps post office to sell stamps with. He was really reliant upon the charity of other bishops and other churches throughout Christendom, and many of them just really resented it. For one reason, a lot of times, and this continued way later, there would be taxes that would be sent out. He would have a tax, what would be called a crusader tax, but there were no crusades.
Uh-huh.
You know, so if you pay your crusader tax, to fight the infidel, and what happens? It ends up being spent on a building that you'll never see.
Right.
There's a lot of resentment that that gets underway with that. Well, eventually, the man who has to bite the bullet on this is Pope Sixtus VI.
Okay.
He'll reign from 1471 to 1484.
So, okay.
And he makes everything more difficult by spending more money.
Now, okay.
There are things that we look at today, of course, and say, wow, this is absolutely wonderful. Thank goodness he did this. The Sistine Chapel.
Exactly.
You know, he built that. He tripled the size of the Vatican Library.
Wow.
Now, that's wonderful. added another dimension to the Vatican Library, scholars.
Ah,
people
okay.
who could spend their day just reading all the books.
Reading and studying, okay.
That's wonderful. he built and restored churches all throughout Rome. He built hospitals. He built roads. There are bridges in Rome that are still of his vintage.
Wow.
You know, all of this stuff. But he also realized that in doing all of this, you need lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided that since he wasn't an expert at this, he brought in a bunch of experts and founded an organization he called the Apostolic Chamber. This was made up of 100, it was a think tank,
mm-hmm.
made up of 100 lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he gave them the mandate, figure out
how to make money.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was necessarily the right thing to do.
I'm guessing we're going to see it probably wasn't exactly the way to go.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Yeah. There are two other things that happened during his reign that really are blemishes, although we're not sure that he had anything to do with either
mm-hmm.
one of these.
Right.
One is the death of one of the de' Medici brothers. There was an assassination attempt, I believe in a church, in fact, on the de' Medici's, a very powerful family.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the brothers, Lorenzo de' Medici, escaped. The other brother was killed.
Mm.
And there is some circumstantial evidence that would link Sixtus VI to this. We have no direct evidence, though,
right.
of that. And then there was a second death also in a prison in Rome, and this was a prominent man. He was an archbishop from the east. His name was Zamometric, and he was the imperial envoy to the Vatican. He had run into some bad relations and made some terrible accusations, and eventually he was put into this prison. He was there 2 years when he committed suicide, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that for a fact, but the fact that that the main object of his criticism had always been Sixtus, and then all of a sudden he comes up dead in a Roman prison, did not look good either for this pope.
But we also know that he's not well liked by many people because of things that he's done.
That's correct.
And we also know that evidence could have been created in that matter too, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Historians have never found a smoking gun on this at all, and often it happens in history that what you're left with is bits and pieces of criticism
mm-hmm.
by critics.
Right.
And that's not hard evidence. You know, and of course, a historian is going to try to work for the hard evidence.
Figure it out, sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what people think of him, but what we don't know is that whether there's any evidence to that. There's
right.
good reason that that people would frame mm-hmm. Pope Sixtus for these. When you look at what else he was doing, I don't know that he had time to go around killing people. You know. So anyway, leave that at for what it's worth.
Right. Okay.
But from a historical point of view, the bottom line is that his pontificate is blemished
mm-hmm.
by these accusations.
Certainly. Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Well, he's followed by Pope Innocent the Eighth, who is a compromised candidate. If you remember, Pope Martin V considered one of the biggest issues, one of the biggest problems that caused the papal schism to last so long was the cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried very, very hard, and especially in the second half of his pontificate, to hone in the cardinals.
Right.
Unfortunately, at this time, there are at least two very powerful cardinals who are set as rivals against each other.
Mm.
And so in the midst of Renaissance Rome, in the midst of Sixtus VI trying to do these things, he has to deal with two very powerful personalities who don't like each other and are trying to head the church in two different directions. One of these is from Spain, Cardinal Borgia.
Okay.
And later he's elected pope. And the other is an Italian, Cardinal Giuliano della Rovere.
Okay.
And he also is elected pope.
Oh, no.
Later on. He's one of the very few popes in history that chooses as his papal title his own name.
Oh, uh-huh.
He becomes Pope Julius II.
Uh-huh.
Giuliano. So anyhow, Innocent VIII is elected. He realizes that he can't go on with these debts.
Mm-hmm.
Sixtus VI has left him between him and Nicholas V has left him a tremendous debt. And so what he does is he uses the advice of the apostolic chamber and finds very creative ways to raise money for the church. And that included establishing new papal offices for which people could buy those positions. There were nominal cardinals. He was giving people this honor as a way of thanking them for huge donations.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that in one example, the son of Lorenzo de' Medici was made a cardinal at 13 years old.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah. Well, he was on the fast track. He later on became Pope Leo
X. Okay.
So, and yet at the same time, Innocent the Eighth, as innocent as he might have been, he had had an illegitimate son in his earlier life, who then took advantage of daddy now being the pope, and his name is Francesco Cibo, and Cibo spent a lot of papal money living very high, just an incredible. Embarrassment to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Innocent died in 1492.
Okay.
And at the conclave, he is going to be replaced by none other than Cardinal Borgia, who has been, since he was 25 years old, had been a cardinal deacon. And now he is elected. He chooses the name Alexander VI. There's a letter that Isabella of Spain writes to someone in Italy and tells them, you could not have chosen a worse candidate for Pope. This man is absolutely corrupt. Trust me, I know him. He's one of my countrymen.
Oh, my goodness.
You know?
Okay.
And it is absolutely true. Alexander had gotten a lot of mileage out of his looks. He was a very handsome man. He was very promiscuous up until his ordination. And even after his ordination, when the Pope discovered that he was, as a priest, had been continuing his promiscuous ways, the Pope reprimanded him. And it seems as though after that reprimand, he actually began to live a celibate life.
Okay.
But that didn't stop a lot of his other
shenanigans. That was a reprimand from Innocent VIII to Borgia?
No, this is going back a little bit earlier, I would guess. I'm guessing here.
I see.
Yeah,
he's
earlier
than
in
that
his life.
This happened. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. As I say, he spends most of his papacy fighting with Cardinal della Rovere. He is the one who is responsible for the condemnation of Savonarola, which we can talk about a little bit later on. Savonarola is this kind of wild monk preacher who gets Florence all excited and everything, and he takes a tent meeting and turns it into a revolution. Ultimately, there'll be a condemnation from the Pope, and he's the one that does that. In order to raise money, he extends out what cannot be called anything other than simony.
Mm-hmm.
And he's selling church offices and church blessings for money. At the same time, he spends an inordinate amount of time on his own personal life.
Mm-hmm.
He is not spending a lot of time on the church, on matters of the church. Instead, he's spending it on his own personal life, and particularly trying to arrange marriages for his 7 illegitimate children. So there you have it. You know, one thing he did do was, you know, it's under his reign that you have the discovery of the Western Hemisphere.
Uh-huh.
Remember? Uh-huh. 1492.
Uh-huh. We are here, 1492.
Yeah. And the one wise thing he did was recognize that he could not oversee the expansion of Christianity into the new world. So he turned around to Ferdinand and Isabella and said, would you mind doing this for me?
Uh-huh.
And they said, fine. You know, you just worry about your stuff and we'll take care of it. And particularly, not so much them, but certainly Charles V, the Emperor Charles V, did a magnificent job of spreading Christianity to the Western Hemisphere. I know that there are people who disagree with that, revisionist historians, and that's a whole other thing we can talk about. But Alexander had very little to do with any of that.
Okay.
You know, one of the greatest church historians of all times, his name is Ludwig von Pastor.
Okay.
And he has written a multi-volume work on church history. But in his book, he says the following, and it is, you know, it's chilling. He says the following. He says, the rehabilitation of Alexander the VI is a hopeless task.
Mm. Wow.
You know, there it is.
Words you wouldn't want to hear about yourself, that's for
Boy,
sure.
Boy, that's for sure, yeah. The one thing is, at the same time, you know, we're recognizing we're dealing with human beings,
mm-hmm.
and this guy is just about as low-down human as you're going to find. It hopefully reminds us that we're not a church of saints.
Right.
Never have been, never will be. We're not a church of saints. We're sinners gathered together in this church, trying through the grace of God to improve our lives and improve the world. But there are those who succeed and those who don't succeed. And occasionally, they happen to be in positions of very high authority. That doesn't take away from the fact that that they do not necessarily respond as well as they could or should have,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so that's just a reality. I think of when we find instances in the church that are discomfortable, and we find people whose personalities just rub us the wrong way, or maybe they don't have personalities, or
mm-hmm.
you know, you just have to shake your head and you say, well, you know, there's a reason why God's using this person, and you know, and there have been worse in the past.
Well, and also we have to remember that fortunately they aren't teaching anything.
Yes.
Because
yes.
they're so occupied with with other parts of their lives that they
yeah.
are not, you know, called fortunately to teach anything.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes it's in this case, it was better to have a not terribly religious pope, you know. Well, anyway, upon his death in 1503, there is a short period of time in which Pius III lives but dies shortly after. And finally, in the next conclave, the rival of Alexander VI,
mm-hmm.
Cardinal Giuliano della Rovere, is elected pope.
Okay.
He chooses the title Julius II, and he is an incredible, tireless worker. This guy had so much energy, it's not even funny. And he set about First of all, he found that the Papal States had come once again under the influence of France,
mm-hmm.
And so he worked tirelessly at moving that away so that there was an independence within the Papal States itself. He streamlined administration within the Vatican. He encouraged reform within the Roman Curia itself and in religious orders. At the same time, he spent an incredible amount of time in wars. I think he might be the only pope that you'll ever see wearing wearing armor.
Oh my goodness!
Riding a war horse. The guy loved battle, and kind of a strange thing for a pope.
Uh-huh.
But there he was, and pitting both France and at times the Holy Roman Empire. One against the other. Now, the Papal States was never what you would call a world military power,
right,
by any means. But this guy took what little he had and he used it, finessing it, in order to gain a certain independence from both the emperor and from the king of France.
Huh.
And respect where he was. Also, at the same time, he really is the one who puts his stamp on the St. Peter's Basilica.
Okay.
The way it looks now, the Bramante Basilica that we have today, really is the work of Julius II. And all of this is going to cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they find a very ingenious way to raise that money. And that is through the sale of indulgences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not new; it had been done before,
mm-hmm.
but it is really now. It's lifted to a fine art. One of the things he does is he farms out the sale of indulgences, so that in order to encourage other people to sell indulgences for various reasons, as we're going to see. This is really going to bite us,
mm-hmm.
in the back of the neck, a little bit down the line. What he does is he sets it up in such a way that he sells papal indulgences at a discount, I guess you could say, to others, so that he would receive, that the Vatican would receive 50% of the money, the proceeds that come from the indulgences themselves. It is just wrong-headed. That's all there is to it.
Right.
He is going to be very much involved with Bramante, as I mentioned, with Michelangelo.
Mm-hmm.
There was a movie that came out about 25, 30 years ago. Was The Agony and the Ecstasy, I think it was. And it dealt with the relationship between Michelangelo and Julius II.
Oh, okay.
Raphael, once again, he's going to be a patron of Raphael. The one thing that he does do for the church is he calls the Fifth Lateran Council.
Oh, okay.
And he was very interested in it. Unfortunately, he died shortly after the council itself was called. This is one of the great reform councils of the church that you never hear about, because after everything was written down, nobody did anything.
Oh,
well,
really?
Not everybody. There were a few, and we'll look at those guys next week. But by and large, the Fifth Lateran Council was a reforming council. They
mm-hmm.
saw the problems in the church,
mm-hmm.
and they began moving toward solving these problems. During the council, a conclave was held, and this is when the son of Lorenzo de' Medici is elected pope. This
okay.
is Pope Leo X.
Okay.
As I say, he's a de' Medici himself. It's his intention of maintaining that independence that the Papal States would have from both France and from the Holy Roman Emperor. Leo X is not, well, he's no Julius II, let's put it that way. And he finds himself trying to play this big league game against big league people,
mm-hmm.
that he was simply out of his class,
right,
in doing that. On the one hand, you had Francis I of France, a very, very powerful individual. And on the other hand, over in Germany, you've got the Emperor Maximilian. And both of these guys are constantly going to war with each other. Way on the other side, you have Henry VII and Henry VIII. So these are big-name people. And he finds himself involved in constant in international relations and alliance building with all of these. In the meantime, he is ignoring the Fifth Lateran Council. And not only that, but he's also ignoring stuff that's going on up north.
Okay.
You know, up particularly in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Even worse than all of that, he has a new drive on indulgence sales. I mean, that is just throwing gasoline onto the fire. But in order to pay for St. Peter's, he does this. It is very unpopular in Germany. Luther is going to use this as a cause celebre to whip up dissent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, shortly before all of this took place, one of the papal legates had been, a man by the name of Aleander, had been in Germany, traveling around Germany, and he writes back that Germany is about to explode. And he begs the Pope that they needed to reform the church, to implement the decisions of the Fifth Lateran Council. They needed to do this right away before this happens. Interestingly enough, as we're going to see next week, in those dioceses where bishops returned to their diocese and implemented the council, those dioceses did not go over to the Reformation. You know, it's very fascinating to see how that happens. Leo X is the one who's famously recorded as saying at the time of his election, turning to his nephews and saying, God has given us the papacy. Mm. Let us now enjoy it. You know? I want to read you a little section. We've got a couple minutes. I want to read you a section from a very substantial book. It's called The Story of the Church. And it's a textbook. It's an older textbook that covers the entire church. This book is going to give you a pro-church spin or slant. Mm-hmm. If you're ever going to find one, it's going to be this. But listen to what this author says, or these authors say, about this period of time. Okay, this is the Renaissance popes. He says, the popes of the Renaissance were great scholars and great politicians, but they were not always great spiritual leaders. As rulers of the papal states, they allowed themselves to be put on the same level with other kings and princes and thus lost their influence for good in matters of eternity.
Yes.
Yeah. Another evil which they allowed to grow up was nepotism. This was the practice of putting their relatives into important positions in the church. They made their nephews cardinals, gave their brothers important posts in the government of the papal states, and in general enriched their own families. Of the 13 popes who reigned from 1431 to 1534, all but three were related by blood to one of their predecessors or successors.
Hmm.
It was a family affair. It cost a great deal of money for the popes to support the artists and the literary men whom they gathered around them in Rome. Some of these, of course, were men of high ideals and found great joy in devoting their talents to the glory of religion. But many of them were seeking only worldly advantage. They lived sinful lives and disgraced the popes before the world. In order to support them and always to pay for the many beautiful buildings and works of art which they created, it was necessary for the popes to make great demands for money upon all the Catholics of the world. This, of course, created a great deal of scandal and discontent. And check this book when this was. It was first published in 1935, and the copy that I have here is from Tan. Copyrighted in 1980. So this is an historian who is, or these are historians who are looking very objectively at these popes, and we can see
not
that
much good to say.
Yeah, You know, and this whole question of nepotism is a very interesting one. I did a little study this past summer on nephews.
Uh-huh.
And being made cardinals and all. And this is not something the Renaissance popes invented. This had been around for a long time. But the other side of it was that, you know, there were, in Italian politics, it was very difficult to know who to trust mm-hmm. and who not to. And so most often, and this is not just the popes who did this, but all good Italian politicians would entrust key positions to people that they could trust, mm-hmm. and that would be people who were from their own clan.
Uh-huh.
You know, in recent history, we saw the same thing had happened in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, and almost everyone, with rare exception, coming from Tikrit, mm-hmm. you know, from his own hometown. This is a way of making sure that you're going to have people on your side, that you don't have to cover your back all the time. They're going to cover it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those things that, that's part and parcel of Italian politics and therefore part of Roman politics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a terrible abuse. It was an abuse because... not because of just having nephews and brothers in these positions, but right. because they abused those positions.
Right, exactly.
You know, had they been good.
Good people themselves.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It would have been something entirely different. But in too many cases, they looked at this as a way to pasture the sheep themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, to use an Ezekiel term. And that's what you end up with. Now, what we'll see is that in the midst of all of this, there is a whole other movement within the church of many of the leaders of the fathers who had been at the Fifth Lateran Council going back and applying the reforms. You're also going to see within the common people themselves this a tremendous devotion. In fact, it's known as the Devotio Moderna. Books are being published. You know, I think I mentioned last week that the Bible was the most mm-hmm. popular book to have. Second most popular was The Imitation of Christ.
Right.
And we're going to find many very devout lay people living together in community as if they were religious, but living holy lives together and giving part of their lives, at least part, in service to the poor. And so there's this other side that's happening, even as we have these tremendous buildings being built in Rome and somebody else having to pay for them.
Right. Yeah. Well, that'll be good to look forward to next week, Father.
Yeah.
And will you close with a prayer for us
okay,
today?
Okay, sure. Heavenly Father, source of all blessings, we ask you to bless us and the work that we do. We ask you to bless our church. It's been through so much, the highs and the lows. We ask you to send your Holy Spirit to us to inspire us always to achieve and to strive to achieve the highest that we can, to be as close to you in imitation of your Son as possible. We pray this prayer in his name. Amen.
Amen.